through it, but you can see there the various dates along the process. I think the one thing that is significant here is that we actually had a budget that was completed in a timely manner, unlike 2 years ago when I'm sure everyone who's on here remembers the chaos that ensued when we had to have a temporary budget for 17 days in July, and then there was a final budget, which changed things. So that was highly chaotic, and it's good that we don't have that situation this time around, although we do have the challenge of substantive changes being made in the reimbursement system for skilled nursing facilities that are effective immediately, July 1, and they haven't been fully developed, so that will require some delay, but it won't be the kind of back and forth that we had with the budget last time. So let's go back a little bit in history to where we were prior to the budget starting. So think about January 1 of this year as an example. So what we were looking at that time was that, and under the statutes as they existed then, that we were looking at rebasing for July 1 of 2021 using the 2019 cost reports, because that was what was in the law. A few years ago, there was a provision added that we actually got added to the statute that called for rebasing every 5 years instead of every 10 years, as was originally the case when we went to the pricing system in 2005. So there was statutory law that said we would have rebasing. But on the other hand, the quality incentive, which I've titled here the new quality incentive, that started January 1, 2020 and then changed July 1, 2020, was going to sunset June 30th of 2021, meaning there would be no more new quality incentive, only the old quality, the one that is funded by the $1.79 reduction from your rate and then redistributed based on the 7 quality metrics. That would have been the only one left under the way that the statute existed as of rough, prior to the budget bill. So you can go forward here, Diane. Thanks. So the governor, as was noted on the previous slide, had the first serve, which is always the case with the budget. The governor introduces the executive budget, and he made a special point in his budget of packaging a number of things relating to skilled nursing facilities together in what the administration called nursing home initiatives protecting Ohio's most vulnerable. I didn't make up that title. That's the title that they had in their materials and when they announced the budget bill. So their package of proposals included the items that you see on the slide here, delaying rebasing for 2 years. So instead of being July 1, 2021, it was under the governor's budget, it was July 1, 2023. Putting the new quality incentive back in the law, which again, it was going to sunset. So they proposed to reinstate it, but make some changes in it. So they were adding money to it, as you can see there, funded at the continuation level plus $50 million per year. They proposed to take out the CHOP and the occupancy exclusions that had existed prior to July 1 of this year. And added in an exclusion for facilities that had quality points below the 33rd percentile. That was what was in the executive budget. But that was only for 1 year. And then for the second year, which would be July 1 of next year, they proposed to allow the Department of Medicaid basically unfettered discretion to change the quality incentive or even to eliminate it if they chose to do so. In the second year of the budget. And there was some language in there that had things like requiring administrators and DONs and medical directors and corporate offices to be located or to reside in Ohio. There were hours requirements for various staff members, including, and this one was kind of hilarious, that that each skilled nursing facility would have a medical director that would work 32 hours a week in the facility. So I challenge any of you that I'd be excited to hear if any of you have a medical director who works 32 hours in your building per week. Now that would have been to qualify for the quality incentive. So the department could do whatever they wanted, but if they did do something, they were to include these things. So that was in the governor's proposal. He also had, as I'm sure everybody's aware, a proposal for a bed buyback program. That was not very, it wasn't very defined, but it was in there and it was funded, as well as a program for paying facilities somehow, some kind of an add-on, if they had low occupancy that extended throughout this fiscal year that's just started. Low occupancy being, I don't even remember how they defined it, but there was, I think it was 10% below their previous occupancy rate. So those were in the governor's budget. Also, they had packaged as part of this nursing home initiatives business some enforcement measures that we'll talk about more later, health orders and reviving the special focus facility statute. And they also had some provisions for some kind of not very well defined quality improvement or technical assistance programs through the Department of Aging. There was, I believe, $23 million in the aging budget as proposed by the executive to fund this and other kind of undefined initiatives. And that money ended up being taken out. So we got somebody. It would really be great if you would mute, please. Thank you. So then that was what was in the executive budget. Then, of course, it was changed in the House, the Senate, and the conference committee. And here's just a very summary statement of what happened at each level. It kind of doesn't matter that much because what eventually came out is what you're going to be living with. So the House, they did put rebasing back into the law. Remember that the executive branch had said, we don't want to do rebasing for 2 years. And the House put it back in, but they funded it at a relatively low level. And they did add funding to the budget as proposed, but that funding all went, or most of it went to the quality incentive. They also included language that was very restrictive in terms of who could qualify for the incentive. And we estimated that probably only about 40 to 45% of buildings would qualify under the House's language. And they also kept in, surprisingly, the health order provision, which was about the director of health having broad discretion to order skilled nursing facilities and assisted livings to do whatever the director wants to order them to do. So that was kept in, although the language was changed in the House, and in their minds at least, it was somewhat of a compromise between eliminating it and having it as the administration proposed. But in reality, it was the administration's proposal with some window dressing on it. When it went to the Senate then reorganized the dollars and had more of them in rebasing and less in quality. They loosened the qualifications for quality somewhat, pretty much to where the budget ended up. So instead of maybe 40% of facilities qualifying, it's maybe more like 70% will qualify as we read the language. The conference committee then basically compromise between the House and the Senate. We had hoped that the Senate version would stay in place, but that did not happen. And as happens on a lot of things, there was a compromise between the two. And so rebasings did stay in, but more money went towards quality, not as far as the House had it, but not as little as the Senate had it on the quality side. They also kept in the House language on health orders, whereas the Senate had eliminated it. So the conference committee kept it in. There was a new development, however, which was not in any version of the budget before, because both all the executive, the House, and the Senate all had level funding for the first year and the second year of the budget in terms of increased funding. The conference committee, however, back-weighted the money, which is problematic because the need is great now. We understand that, but the money was there was an increase in funding, but the increase was more in the second year, and we'll see the details of that in a little bit. The governor did issue line item vetoes, as always, right before signing the bill. He did veto many fewer provisions than in his first budget 2 years ago, and for long-term services and supports, and specifically skilled nursing. The last time the vetoes came out of left field and were significant in terms of they cut out a bunch of funding, or at least the language to spend the money. This time around, there was one change that we'll talk about later on for the skilled nursing provisions, but it was very, very minor, so minor as to be really insignificant. And the bulk of the language turned out to be, you know, all the substantive language turned out to be the same as in the conference committee. Here is just a table we put together, and it really shows you, and this doesn't just include skilled nursing, but it also includes the other providers that we represent at OHCA. But for our discussion, we'll focus on the top part of the table about skilled nursing. And this just shows from the executive to the House to the Senate and then the conference, which, as I mentioned, was the final result, how the funding changed, both in terms of the amount and in terms of the allocation of it. So we've got rebasing, we've got the continuation of quality, which was just keeping quality in place since it was supposed to sunset, and then the amount of additional money added on to the quality incentive and the total. So you can see that the executive was putting in $440 million, of which really only $100 million was new money, since the $340 was a continuation. The House increased that by a couple hundred million dollars, and some of that went to rebasing, as you can see there, but most of it went to the quality. They added $117 million to quality above and beyond what the executive had proposed. Then in the Senate, you can see how that reversed itself, that it went from 100 and 217 to 348 for rebasing and 50 for an additional quality. And that was about $80 million more overall than the House. And then the conference committee kept the same basic amount of money as the Senate, but then compromise, as I said before, between the House and the Senate on how much went to rebasing versus how much went to quality. So you can see it was kind of a middle ground there. And I love it. Diana's doing these slides perfectly. No, don't have to say turn the next slide. Thank you, Diane. So just look, focusing in then on rebasing and how that turned out. So as I said, the way that the statute was originally written, or was written up until the budget bill, they were supposed to be rebasing July 1, and this was according to the five-year schedule, and then the administration had proposed to get rid of it, or not to do it for 2 years, to postpone it is better than get rid of. So the budget bill, as I mentioned, retained rebasing, but made several changes. And this is really where we want to focus in, because this is what is different. Now, rebasing would have changed rates anyway, of course. That's the whole idea, is to recalculate. Rebasing is recalculating all of the prices for the four cost centers and coming up with new prices and then applying those to your rates as of whatever the date is, the effective date that it's supposed to take. So that was going to be a change anyhow. But what the budget bill did was to make changes in how rebasing is done. So it's like, not only do we have a change in rates, we have a change in how rates are calculated. So that makes it more complicated and more difficult. and why we don't, as of today, know what the rates are going to look like. I just got an email a little bit ago from someone asking, hey, what's my rate going to be? And that's totally to be expected, but the answer is we don't know yet. So here are what the changes are. The most important one is that they capped the amount of rebasing at $125 million per year. So $250 for the total biennium, $125 for each year. We estimated the annual amount. We did this a couple of times, but our final estimate, depending on the amount, the number of days, Medicaid days you assume, would have come down to something between $230 and $260 million per year. That's a kind of a broad range, and truthfully, you know, depending on, again, how many Medicaid days you assume, it could be even outside of that range. And the Medicaid days are really important in turning rebasing into a total dollar spend, because rebasing is really really about changing the rates, as I said. So, you know, the rates are going to change by X amount. In this case, of course, increasing by X amount. So if you take the statewide average rate and you rebase it, you're going to have an increase of, again, X, whatever that number is. But that's a per diem amount. That's what the rate, how much the rate changes. When you're talking about, as the legislature wanted to do and chose to do in the final version of the budget, when you're talking about a total spend, because that's what they care about, is how much money, how much of the taxpayers' money are we spending in this particular area? To do that, you have to multiply the rate times some assumed number of Medicaid days. So we have no idea how many Medicaid days there are going to be in skilled nursing facilities in this fiscal year that started July 1 and runs for another 12 months. We have even less idea how many days in a skilled nursing facility or in skilled nursing facilities across the state there will be in the next fiscal year that doesn't start for a year from now. I mean, it's complete guesswork. Now, it can be educated guesswork based on historical trends, what we've seen over the last, you know, number of months and years, really. You can make an educated guess, but you don't know for sure. So when you're trying to figure out how much is rebasing going to cost the state, or how much funding is going to be received by providers, you have to do two things: calculate that per diem increase, and then assume that there will be a certain number of Medicaid days. So that is what makes this really challenging, and why we can't say, yeah, rebasing is going to be X number of dollars per day, or for Happy Acres facility, that it's going to be X number of dollars per day, because we don't know how the department is going to project Medicaid days. The legislature did not say you will assume a certain number of Medicaid days or a certain per diem increase. They just said, we only want to spend $125 million on rebasing. You, Department of Medicaid, figure it out. So that's where it stands today. So they did specify a bit on how they are supposed to figure it out. So they looked at the cost centers, and as I said, when we do rebasing, we rebase all four cost centers. Well, they said, not so fast. We don't want capital to be rebased. And I'll just very briefly comment on that, at the risk of taking time, you know, more time from this. There was some advocacy by a particular provider and an organization that provider basically is a kind of coterminous, that you know, the capital is being abused by certain providers who are landlords who are charging exorbitant rates and colluding with their lessees to you know, jack up the lease rates that will then go and raise the capital rebasing amount. That got some currency in the legislature. Unfortunately, we tried to fight it. but it didn't, it still had some currency. So they basically decided we're not comfortable with capital being rebased, and they said it won't be rebased. So as we look at rebasing in the $125 million and how that would be applied on a cost center basis or on a facility-specific basis, we are directed, or the department is directed, not to rebase capital. And then the other cost centers are supposed to be rebased in priority order. So direct care is the highest priority, ancillary and support is second, and taxes is third. But how exactly that is supposed to be done, it was not described, other than that it was supposed to be done pro rata. So in my mind, pro rata is equal, okay? When I say I'm going to pay everybody their pro rata share, it's kind of like, okay, everybody's going to get an equal share, or a share that's based on an equal percentage of something. And so that goes against the notion of prioritizing, because you could say, okay, we'll put the entire rebasing into direct care. Let's say that normally direct care would eat up $125 million. Okay, we're done. But that's not pro rata. So it'll be interesting to see how the department ends up applying that. Then there was a provision that we'll talk about more, about stating that when you get this additional funding for rebasing, whatever it turns out to be, that you have to use 70% of it for direct care expenses. And you're not supposed to use any of it for capital, which, again, we'll talk about that as much as we know about it in a couple minutes. They also put in a provision saying never again will capital be rebased, which is really a bizarre statement. I mean, it kind of suggests, if you think it through, that we don't want any kind of improvements to be made to facilities. We don't want new facilities to be built, anything like that. It's got things that would cost more than whatever the current costs are. So, or really more like whatever the 2014 costs were, because that's what the old rates are, really previous rates were built or based on. So that's there. We'll see what happens. The quality incentive is also changed significantly under House Bill 110. So to start with, it was reinstated. So it did not go away as scheduled on June 30th, but it is sunsetted 2 years from now. So in theory, we would go through the same dance in 2 years that we just went through with this budget bill as it relates to the quality incentive. Now, rebasing presumably won't be on the table in 2 years, but the quality incentive will be. With the caveat that we'll get to in a little bit about the study committee on all of this. So some of the key parts about the quality incentive: there is no more old quality incentive. So the seven metrics and the redistributing of the $1.79 deduction have been removed. The $1.79 deduction is still there. So that is going to happen. That it's just that money will now, instead of going into a pot to be distributed based on seven metrics, it'll go into the same pot as the other money that's going to be distributed based on the four metrics, i.e. the new, quote unquote, new quality incentive. So the old one was eliminated. We're folding it into the new one. And that means there's only one set of metrics, which is actually something we support. We didn't think it made sense to have two sets of metrics determining different pots of money. As I mentioned before, the estimate for how much continuation of the quality incentive amounts to is $170 million per year. So that's where that 340 came from that was on the table. And then as also shown on the table, the budget bill adds another $25 million to that. So we're talking $195 million in FY22. And then an additional $100 million, so it would be $295 million in the quality pool for FY23. So that's when I said it was back weighted, that's where it comes in. There's more quality money in year two than there is in year one. Rebasing is the same in both years. As I said, the same four metrics would be used, and the basic calculation methodology is the same as it was. Here are where the exclusions turned out. And of course, you all are aware of the current exclusions for occupancy and CHOPS. Excuse me. The new exclusions will start with, and the most significant one is the 25th percentile. So remember when I mentioned the governor's proposal was the 33rd percentile, now it's the 25th. So it's a little bit lower. As a practical matter, what that means is if you get fewer than 10 quality points, that's what we estimate it to be. It hasn't been confirmed by the department. But if you get fewer than 10 quality points, you'll get no quality incentive. The 33rd percentile would have been 11 points. So if you're between 10 and 11, you know, that was a significant change to go from the 33rd to the 25th. But there still will be basically a quarter of the facilities in the state who will be excluded by virtue of this provision. But it's going to be based on the quality incentive or the quality points, not on occupancy. CHOPS will continue to be excluded in the same manner as they are today or as they were prior to July 1. So that means if you acquire a facility, there is a CHOP that occurs sometime during the fiscal year, whether it's July 1, January 1, any other time. Immediately upon that CHOP being finalized, and this doesn't include a stock sale, it would only include things that are actually considered CHOPs or defined as CHOPs. Once that transaction takes place, the new operator does not get that quality incentive. If the old operator had one, it goes away immediately. And that is the way it is now, or the way it was before, and will continue to be. The other piece of that is that you have to have four quarters of a calendar year of data under the CMS quality measures under the current provider agreement. So if, for example, you acquired a facility and there was a CHOP, say it was August 1 of 2020, so nearly a year ago, you as the new provider would not have four quarters of data from 2020 under your provider agreement. So you would get zero now. Going forward, you would get zero. Now, as of July 1 of 22, you would have four quarters because you'd be looking back at calendar year 21. And since the CHOP took place in 2020, you would be the operator all of 2021. And if you had enough points, you would qualify and be able to get a quality incentive, again, starting July 1 of 22. So it can be a very lengthy exclusion or not as long exclusion depending on what time of year the CHOP took place. You know, later in the year, the less long that exclusion will turn out to be. Then also new buildings. This is again similar to what it is it was before. It goes back to that full calendar year. So if a new building comes online, they're not going to have a full calendar year for the year that they came online, and they're going to have to wait to get the quality incentive, which doesn't make a lot of sense in my mind, but that's what the law says. An add to this, this is a new thing that is not in the current language, similar to the previous language, similar to the 25th percentile, is that special focus facilities as of May, which of course that's known, that May was in the past, whoever was a special focus facility as of that time is not going to get a quality incentive going forward. At all times there are five facilities on the quality or on the special focus list, whether they're new adds to the list, whether they're not improving, whether they are improving, they're all considered to be on the list, and so they would not get the quality incentive. Interestingly enough, all five of the current special focus facilities or the special focus facilities as of May would have otherwise qualified. They were above the 25th percentile, which is kind of an interesting fact. There was a minor drafting error in how they defined the language, defined the three tables on the quality, on the on the special focus facility lists, and it was incorrect. They misdefined one of the tables, so they took that those definitions out, but there's still references to the tables, which are the names of the tables A, B, and C are still correct. They just defined them wrong. So that was the only thing that was vetoed as it relates to skilled nursing. There was a question that came in chat, so I'm going to go to that. So the question is, if an existing operation moves into a new building from an old building, would that be considered an exclusion, or is exclusion only for a new building and a new operation? So the question, or the answer to that question, depends on the provider agreement. I think in most cases when that happens, if not all, there is a new provider agreement issued. It's considered to be a new provider, even though it is a replacement for a previous facility that may have been operated by the same company. So I believe that, assuming that that is the case, that it that is a new provider agreement, then they would not receive the quality incentive. If the provider agreement, I don't know if there's any circumstances where this would occur, but if the provider agreement transfers over, I don't know of any, but if there are any, then I believe it would be the facility would get the quality incentive. A couple of other things here on this slide, we estimated that about 270 to 280 buildings are excluded. There is not, by these various criteria, and will be excluded for July 1 under these criteria. It's a little bit hard to tell because there's no real complete list of all the CHOPs and new buildings that's published out there anyplace, so we kind of have to infer from other data sources that when those have occurred. So that's why it's a range, and we can't say precisely this number will be excluded. Also, we haven't officially, you know, the state hasn't officially calculated that 10 as being the 25th percentile. Oh, I think it will be. Sorry, for some reason I'm getting lots of phone calls right at the moment. Last thing is that the occupancy criteria did kind of go away. They're still in the law. But obviously the 80% occupancy piece is very troubling when you talk about COVID and the fact that the average occupancy in Ohio is around 70%. So that was waived for 2 years until July 1 of 23, which is, again, kind of weird because we don't really know that there will be a quality incentive after July 1 of 23 or if it will be changed in some significant fashion that would make the occupancy criteria irrelevant. This is just a listing of the various special rate provisions that are in the statute. You can see them there. I won't go over them in detail, but none of those things changed except to the extent that they're recalculated each year, such as, for example, who qualifies for the high occupancy, what the vent rates are, which they have been, those have been announced and they're listed there. Or if you qualified as a critical access facility, those are all based on data. But the formulas for them have not changed. So how are rates going to be set for July 1? So one thing that was important in the budget bill, that we were concerned about before was whether there would be a delay in when the rates would be effective, not when they would actually be calculated and announced, because we knew there was going to be a delay in that, but when they would be effective. So there was some wrangling towards the end of the process about, you know, could the legislature make these various changes that we just talked about effective July 1, or do they have to wait for 90 days? And the final answer was, it's okay to make them effective for July 1, so that's what the final bill says. ODM issued an announcement about the time that the budget bill passed, or it might have been a day or two before that, they were not going to have rates ready July 1. So I think it was June 28th or something like that when they announced this. And it's like, yeah, that's not shocking. They did not provide any date for, you know, they did not pin themselves down as far as when they will be done. We've had very little, I said virtually no, but hardly any discussion with the department about how they are going to implement the budget bill. As you know, you heard over the last few minutes, there are lots of questions, lots of unanswered questions about different pieces, and they have not shared how those are going to be addressed. And I hope that there will be some give and take on that. They did tell us this morning, we had a meeting with the department this morning that was a regularly scheduled meeting. We had asked to have some conversation about the rate setting, and they deferred that to a subsequent meeting that yet to be scheduled. And frankly, that meeting isn't going to happen until after the 19th of July, because Patrick Beatty is on vacation, and they said they wanted to have him involved in it. He's one of the deputy directors at the department. So it's going to be a bit before we even have any conversation with them or learn anything about what they're thinking about some of these provisions. So that leads to the next point. I would not be surprised if August 15th rolls around, and August 15th is significant because that's when they would start paying claims, or roughly when they would start paying claims for July dates of service, which would be affected by the new rates. If the rates are not ready and they're not able to implement them by August 15th, then what they are directed by statute to do, and this was a pre-existing statute, is to pay the previous rate, that is whatever your rate was June 30th, and then once they complete the rates, then the new rates, then they would settle up the difference. So in most cases, if not all, there'll probably be some providers who, for a combination of reasons, would end up with lower rates. Say you had a big quality incentive now and you lose your quality incentive, the rebasing is not going to make up for that. Or maybe if you had a big dip in your CMI, that might drive your rate down, after everything's factored in. So there might be some situations like that. But, you know, the vast majority are going to be increases, so there would be an additional payment coming from the state, but it's going to be after the fact. It would be after the fact. If I were a betting man, and I'm not, I would put the odds on that the rates won't be ready by August 15th, but hopefully I'm wrong about that, and they will, and they can calculate them. The problem, as you've probably figured out by now, is that we can't calculate the rates either because of all of those uncertainties. So when the folks, many of you probably have asked, and others are asking, hey, you know, what's my rate going to look like? We can't tell you, at least not accurately. But we can give you some idea. So what we know as of now for the July 1 rates is that the basic rate methodology is going to stay the same. CMI is going to be done the same way. It's still the two-quarter average. It still is going to be adjusted every 6 months normally, except in CHOP situations, you know, things where they wouldn't have been adjusted already. The only difference in the basic methodology, as I mentioned before, is that old quality is going away. So that won't be part of the calculation. Every other piece is still going to be there. Rebasing then, what we know about rebasing is the 2019 cost reports will be used. The existing formula for rebasing will be used by cost center. So those are still in statute. I mean, every word of it is still in statute, as far as how the rebasing is supposed to be done. But then there is this overlay of the $125 million cap and this instruction about which cost centers would then get portions of that capped amount. So then there'll have to be some kind of allocation among the cost centers, which we've already talked about, other than capital. So the other three, they're going to have to allocate the money somehow. We just don't know how that's going to happen. The quality incentive, of course, we know certain things. We know how the pool is defined, the pool of money that will be distributed. We know roughly how much it is. We know that the points will be calculated using the four-quarter averages from calendar year 2020 and the and the cut points that are already in existence. That's not a change. We know that the bottom percentile for each metric, so it would be the bottom quintile for three of them and the bottom decile for the other one. Those all default to zero. That's the same as it's been. We have completed an unofficial calculation of each facility's quality points. So that's why we're able to know that the 25th percentile is 10. So that all is done. We know that. I mean, again, it's unofficial, but we know pretty much what it is. And we've, as I said, identified how many exclusions there were would be and who they are. Again, unofficially, and in some cases, a little bit of a guess. We're in a ballpark on that. So those are the things we know. What we don't know is how many total Medicaid days Medicaid's going to project. The department is going to project in 22. Fiscal 22, and I went over that already. We just don't know. We know what 2019 was. The department is going to know what 2020 was. We don't at this point because we don't have the cost report data. We do have other sources that we can kind of guess what they were in 2020, but that's 2020. It's not FY 22. It's not July 1 of this year through June 30th of next year. So that requires a little bit of guesswork. And does the department say, oh, occupancy is going to bounce right back to where it was and beyond, and we'll have just as many Medicaid days as we had in 2019? That would be kind of stupid. I think we all recognize that that's not going to happen. But what we don't know, and is just purely somebody, you know, throwing a dart at the dartboard, is how much, I mean, occupancy is bouncing back very slowly. So how much will it continue to bounce back, and how far will it bounce back over that period of time? How quickly and how much, and that's really, I mean, that's witchcraft there. It's like, you don't know. But the department's going to have to make some assumption on that in order to project the cost of rebasing to then compare it to the 125. So, as I said, that drives the total dollar cost of rebasing is how many Medicaid days there are. We estimate, this is an OHCA estimate, not a ODM estimate, that if we were to do rebasing fully the way that the statute was before House Bill 110, it would be an average across the state, an average of $16.35 higher than the current or the previous prices. So if you take that number and you multiply it out by some number of Medicaid days, it can give you an idea. That's where we came up with the range of somewhere between 230 and 260, depending on which number of Medicaid days you pick, and you multiply that by 1635, that gives you that total number. So you can see, obviously, that that's a significant difference from 125. And so the per diem is going to have, the total per diem increase is going to have to be ratcheted down in order to hit the 125. And then it has to be allocated among cost centers and all of that. But I think you kind of start with the notion that, the per diem is going to have to be artificially lowered in order to get to the cap. As for what we also, but we don't know what any of those numbers are going to be exactly. We also don't know exactly how much the value per quality point is going to be. We have a guess, but we don't know for sure. That's because we don't know what 5.2% of the base rate is going to be. We do know what the $179 deduction is going to be approximately. And we know the $25 million is added on. But so we've got a pretty good idea what the total pot of money is, but not for sure. We also don't have the 2020 Medicaid days, as I mentioned. The department does have that, or will have that, and we'll have that piece of the puzzle. The base rate, of course, is dependent on rebasing, and they'll have to figure out how to do that first. Then we don't know, as I mentioned before, about how they're going to allocate the rebasing amount among cost centers. So here's an attempt to put it all together. So we estimate the value per quality point will be about a dollar. It might be $1.10, a little bit higher than that. But I think a good conservative estimate would be a buck, just for purposes of trying to project, you know, what you're going to get. We are guessing, this is really, really a guess, that rebasing may be about $8 a day on a statewide average basis. Again, that depends on what number of Medicaid days you use for the calculation, but we're assuming, you know, a reasonable number of Medicaid days, not a real tiny number, not as many as there were in 2019, but some reasonable number in between there. So that's about half of that $16.35 that we came up with. So, you know, that's what it turns out, what we think it's going to turn out to be in that ballpark. That will not be every facility gets $8, if that's what the number turns out to be, or 8.25 or 7.75 or whatever it is. That will vary by facilities on a number of factors, which you can see there. So, you know, you shouldn't expect it's going to be a flat amount that everybody gets. It's going to be different. So here's how to do your own ballpark rate estimate based on that information. So you take your June 30th rate, your old rate, you take out the quality payments because those are either going away or they're going to be redone. And if you were a critical access facility, those couple handfuls of critical access facilities, take that out too because that's going to be redone. You take out your old CMI and then you put in your new CMI, which you would do normally. That's the way it's always been, you know, using the December, March average. You look and see if the facility is going to have a quality is going to be excluded from the quality incentive. And that is based on all of those, you know, the percentage, are you under 10, did you have a CHOP, you know, that kind of stuff. You'll know that. You'll know if you're going to be excluded or not based on those things. You know if you're a special focus. So then if you qualify, you're not under any of the exclusions, I would suggest taking your number of new quality points that you've calculated and multiply that by a dollar. You know, that's just a conservative number. And then if you were or think you might be a critical access facility, you know what your 2020 cost report shows in terms of occupancy and in terms of Medicaid utilization, which are the two metrics. And so you would know if you get to continue being a critical access facility, or at least have a good idea. You know, it's not official, of course. And then just plug in $8 for rebasing. Again, knowing, understanding when you do this, it's not precise. And so if you're doing this for somebody else, you got to caveat this up and say, hey, yeah, this is the number I came up with, but this $8 is a plug number. That's a ballpark number. It could be higher or lower than that. You might have some sense based on peer groups, based on, you know, things, you know, what your CMI is compared to the average, things like that, whether you're going to be a little above or a little below that. And that $8 is to start with a guess. I thought I saw a chat question come in. I know we're pushing up on time here too. There's a question or a comment about what were the CON changes. I'll try to hit that quickly. Is there a way to get your calculations to line them up against mine? I have not done calculations for every facility. I'm just, because again, it's like when you start doing calculations, it starts looking like it's something real and precise, and it's not. That's why I laid it out for how you can do your own. Now, as far as the quality points, if you've got a question about that, you don't have those. I can give you those because I think those are pretty solid. Okay, that was the question. So yeah, just send me an email separately and I can give you what I've got on those. The CON changes very quickly were very minor in one way and very major in another way. The minor way is that they raised the renovation threshold from 2 million to 4 million. And the major change is that they did not continue the moratorium. So to the extent that you're doing projects or you want to do projects that would have been caught by the moratorium over the last couple of years, such as rebuilding a replacement facility, that's no longer in effect. As of today, it's no longer in effect. So here's another item in the budget bill that's very odd and came in at the very last minute. And that's the 70% provision. And I'll just give you a very quick overview of that, and then and because a lot of it's unknown. But as I said, the statute says when you get whatever you get for rebasing, whether it's $8 a day or whatever it is, whatever it turns out to be, that you are supposed to spend 70% of it on direct care costs and none of it on capital. Now, that's a really bizarre thing because, of course, you know, you don't spend money based on where it comes from, what part of the rate it comes from. It's all just revenue. Now, I recognize with the Provider Relief Fund and the kind of the special funding things, you do have to track that. This is kind of taking that same concept and applying it to part of your Medicaid rate, which is a very odd way of looking at things, but that's what it is. Beyond that, we really can't say anything about how this is going to be done because it's really going to be up to the department, and they're going to have to either write rules or in some fashion determine how they are going to look at this, what kind of reporting is going to be required because there is some reporting, and then they can do audits and recover funding if they determine that you didn't spend the money the way you were supposed to. So, again, I know it's now 11:59, and I might go a couple minutes over just because we started late, but I do want to be mindful of your time as well. But just looking ahead very quickly, we do have that increase in quality in the second year, so that is one change that is kind of for sure at this point. But then going beyond that, there is going to be yet another legislative commission to look at skilled nursing facility rates. And it is purely legislative. It's 8 members of the legislature. They haven't been appointed yet. They have to have a report out by August 31st of next year. And the slide lists what they are supposed to consider. This is language right out of the statute. So they're looking at quality incentive formula. They're looking at the base rate calculation for quality. Now, I know what that is, but I think what they mean there is basically how rates are calculated, the rest of the rate is calculated, and then cost centers that are redetermined as part of rebasing. So that's kind of looking at the rest of the rate. And then they stuck on at the very last minute that buyback program. So that made a recovery of a sort. I read this as meaning, I read this as meaning that they are really going to be potentially looking at the entire reimbursement system, not just quality metrics or some specific limited part of it, but they can look at the whole thing. Now, they may choose to limit their scope, but I think that we're going to be prepared to discuss with this committee or this commission, the entire reimbursement system and things that we think need to be changed, because especially as they have mushed it around with this budget bill, the reimbursement system is becoming more and more untenable. But that is yet to come. These are some miscellaneous language changes. I'm not going to spend any time on that. They're all minor, I believe, unless we find out somehow that they are interpreting them differently. The health orders provision ended up going in. This is a very broad-based provision that allows them to issue orders pretty much whatever they want. I think in the interest of time, the key thing I want to bring to your attention is the second bullet there, that all of this authority that the Director of Health will have to direct facilities, SNFs and assisted livings, both, to do things is based on a determination made by the director only. Nobody else is looking at this determination to see whether they agree with it or not. That immediate action is necessary to protect resident health or safety because a home has neglected or refused to act with sufficient promptness or efficiency to protect resident health and safety. So, in other words, in the director of health's own opinion, there's a problem. There's a problem with health and safety. It's not immediate jeopardy. It's not any other definition that we know. It's just the director of health's opinion. And based on that, the legislature has given the director of health extraordinary power. It was based on, as I said here on the slide, a few horror stories that the director has shared as basically, again, stories, not any verified facts that she was concerned about. So here's some details. Again, we won't go into it in at great length, but it can be done without any hearing beforehand. And there's a listing there of some of the things that can be done, which is basically anything that the director determines is necessary for protecting public health and safety. And the home pretty much has to comply with that order, because if they fail to do so, the director can take direct action, which presumably means a cadre of people from the Department of Health will walk in and start running the building. In addition to, there would be a fine shall be imposed. It is a mandatory fine of up to $100,000 for each instance. So let's say the director issued five orders to a facility. That could be $500,000 in fines for not complying. And it doesn't matter if the facility felt in good faith that the orders were inappropriate. They do have the right, and we'll skip that section. There's some provisions for them to appeal if they wish different things, but that's all after the fact. You can appeal these orders after the fact. Why don't you just go to that slide, Diane? Skip this one, go to the next one. So here's the things you can appeal, again, after the fact, that the director acted in violation of the statute. In other words, there really wasn't a threat to health and safety. But again, it's the director's opinion. I mean, what hearing officer employed by the director of health is going to say the director was wrong in her opinion? I mean, I don't know. If somehow you can go to court on these, but if the facility ends up prevailing, they are able to get their expenses back. Of compliance expenses if they complied with the order. There's also an appeal of the reasonableness of the amount of the fine. And you can also appeal if the director ordered all the people out of the building, that's supposed to only last for 30 days. And if the director says, well, it needs to be longer than that, then you can appeal that termination. The next slide just shows it's an expedited appeal, which is okay, I guess, but it kind of doesn't matter because you're already under the order. You're already running the potential of getting nice big fat fines. So it's okay. So you get an appeal quickly afterward, relatively quickly. But that's, again, afterward. So here are the CON things. I already covered that in relation to Harry's question, so I don't think we need to cover that in any more detail other than just to say that basically we've gone back to the way things were before the moratorium and the various ways that you could move beds around, add beds, and so forth, other than the bed need part of it, which isn't going to happen again. That only happens periodically, and it won't happen again until really 2024 is when I'll start looking at applications. Special focus facilities, they tried to fix the issues with the statute on terminating special focus facilities. That's of course very limited in scope to those who are special focus facilities. We tried to keep them from doing that and get rid of the statute, but that didn't happen. And then the last item, you can just move up one more, Diane. Okay, it's fighting her. The last item is just about expedited surveys. And it expanded a little bit when you could get an expedited survey. All right. So that is it. Did we have any further questions? Looks like there might be a couple here. Would equipment for patient care that can be capitalized count as a 70%, or would that not be permitted? The 70% would be based on the definition of direct care that is in the statute for purposes of the cost center for direct care. So if it is capital equipment that has been capitalized and is in the capital cost center, then it would be considered direct care, even though we could make the argument that it is. And there are some things that are in, for example, ancillary and support that people might consider to be direct care, and it's just that they're just defined as not being. All right. Well, we thank you very much. I saw that Brian Casey had said that maybe he was recording the video, so that would be great if he was able to do that, and we can get that posted. But in any event, we will post the slides shortly. And certainly, if you have further questions, I've seen a couple come in here by email. So if you have further questions, you know where to find us, and we'd be happy to get you answers to the extent we know them. So everybody have a good afternoon, and we will talk with you later on.
Goodbye.